So, Rob, I'm gonna let you kick it off. I thought this was an apt topic coming on the heels of Governor Youngkin getting sworn in Virginia, which has been a focal point for a lot of these clashes over curricula and policy. So, tell us
Okay.
about why Europe might be someplace, because usually we think, oh gosh, we don't want to be like Europe. We don't want to have a European welfare state.
It's interesting because Europe, European countries are held up as great examples of the welfare state, but there are certain respects in which they are more pro-free market than we are, and it's strange. So, and you get this all tied up with the sort of Bernie Sanders thing where he says. There was a great thing that happened in about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, during one of Bernie Sanders' runs for president. Where he says, "Well, really, what I want is, when I say socialism, what I want is a country like Denmark." And you had the Danish prime minister saying, "But we're not socialists," and being very insistent about that because basically doesn't want to scare off investors. But it is true that they have a more generous welfare state on the whole, but in some cases they have. Certain kinds of taxes are lower and certain other things are freer. And I'm going to get to an example having to do with schools, where school choice is considered this radical libertarian idea, introduced by Milton Friedman, and sort of viewed as a far out, until very recently viewed as a far out idea, but has actually been fairly common in Europe for a very long time, and for reasons that I think have a lot to do with the school wars. Going on, or that relate very directly, offer a solution to the school wars we're having. So let me go back to the school wars we're having for a minute. And yes, this is partly inspired by Glenn Youngkin and his campaign for governor and how that campaign went, which sort of it wasn't the beginning of the school wars here, but it sort of brought it very much to national attention, and I think has inspired and encouraged a lot of imitators elsewhere. And the primary thing they had attention for was the idea of the sort of the as this as part of the woke wars. Now, the woke wars of the so-called progressive left having this ideology of what is sometimes referred to as being woke, being awakened to systemic oppression. And seeing signs of that systemic oppression everywhere, including in the pronouns people use and in all these various little details of language, that culture war has been raging very strongly, I think, since about 2014, and hasn't really connected to the average voter that much because it's something that is a lot of that's going on if you're on Twitter, right? And if you're on social media, if you're highly politically engaged, that looms large in your life. But for the average person and for the, I think for the perhaps more psychologically healthy person, they don't spend a lot of time engaged in that. So it's something that happens off there on Twitter. It happens on Fox News. It happens among the political presence in their minds. But where it really reaches out and grabs people is when it shows up in your kid's school. So when your kid is coming home, as mine did a while back, with assignments based on the 1619 project, right? So this idea that America is systemically racist and has been so since the very beginning, and no matter how much they have to torture history to make that happen, and that was very deliberately being disseminated out into the schools, and especially in the public schools, being very eagerly adopted by. By teachers and education bureaucrats who were very sympathetic to that woke agenda. So suddenly that's showing up in your kids' schools, and that's where it really reaches out and affects people. And that's how it became an issue in the election in Virginia last November. And specifically, where it came out was Terry McAuliffe, the former governor who was running again. Who was the Democratic candidate, made a gaffe, and a gaffe, of course, being defined as when a politician accidentally tells the truth. And he said his gaffe was that he says he didn't think parents should be allowed to control what's taught in their kids' schools. And that sort of summed up for a lot of people the bureaucratic mentality of, you know, we the bureaucrats, we control everything, you have no say whatsoever. And that's what sort of, you know, before McAuliffe said that he was leading by five points in the polls, he ended up losing by 5 points in the polls. That was the point at which the polls flipped and the voters turned against him. And like I said, that encourages a lot of other people who are now saying they're sort of passing these anti-woke school bills across the country. Now, the problem with that actually comes from the original context in which McAuliffe said that. Because the original context was that McAuliffe was being challenged on a case that happened in Virginia in, I think, 2013. And it was where a mother threw a fit because her son had gone into an AP advanced placement English class and was assigned a book with some sort of somewhat sexually overt subject matter. Now, he's a senior in high school in an AP class deliberately designed to be reading college-level material. But she got all upset about the idea that, oh, this was too much for him. This tender young 18-year-old shouldn't be reading this. So it was a little bit, it wasn't, you know, that this was something woke being imposed. This was much more of a little church lady-ish kind of objection about, I want to be able to dictate to the schools that they can't assign these things, where, you know, it could have been, well, if kid's not ready for this material, he shouldn't be taking this AP class. So it was a little more of an ambiguous case. And I think that sort of set the tone for a lot of things I'm worried about with the anti-woke bills being passed. So you have some of these bills where they allow, people to come and challenge and get lists of books that are in the libraries and demand that certain books be removed from the school libraries. Or there's my favorite example of one that is a clear kind of overreach is that provides, I think is being proposed in Florida, although this has been done in different forms elsewhere, which provides bounties where parents who inform on teachers who are teaching unapproved ideas in the schools can get the teachers fired and the parents forming on a teacher who's teaching the wrong things. And you can see how this begins to get kind of intrusive. And there have also been questions about some of these anti-woke bills are saying you can't teach anything that would assign anything to students that would make them feel uncomfortable based on their race. And somebody's saying, well, what if I wanted to teach about some of these debates around the Civil War and I want to assign a speech by somebody who's defending the Confederate position, and I wanted to assign that so we can study what the Confederate position was, but under the strict reading of the law, that would actually be outlawed. So there's a whole section of education that you simply cannot teach. Certain things you can't assign that are relevant, important information, but because the law is so overly broadly worded. So that shows the problem we're having with the woke wars. Because on the one hand, you have the people trying to impose the woke ideas and the 1619 Project and what have you in the classrooms. And on the other hand, you have people saying, well, to fight back against that, we're going to pass a bunch of laws basically entitling bureaucrats or parents as sort of vigilante enforcers to go monitor and control and every little thing that's being said in the classroom. So it's almost like you have a conservative political correctness that's being imposed on the classrooms. And so I was looking for a way out of this woke wars. And the obvious answer is school choice. The idea of using school choice to say, well, instead of having a battle over who gets to control what's taught in the public schools, it makes much more sense to say, let's let people have their money back to go pay for their own kids' education. And then they can choose what kind of school they want their kids to go to. They could choose to go to a religious school or a secular school or a super woke school, but they can make that choice about their own children's education. And what fascinated me is I found out that this is basically what happened in Europe many years earlier. And this is a piece I have, I'm going to write this all out in a piece that is going to be published probably tomorrow morning in Discourse magazine from the Mercatus Institute. But I looked at a specific case of Belgium Now, Belgium is a country that was actually originally formed to be a Catholic country. It sort of broke off from the rest of the Netherlands because it was the Catholic enclave there. And so over the 19th century and into the 20th century, there were these vicious battles that they had over separation of church and state, that there was a one party and one faction that wanted this to be very much a Catholic country with Catholicism as the official religion imposed on people, including through the schools. And there was a giant battle. There's what we call the First School War in the 19th century. And then in the middle of the 20th century, they called it the Second School War. And it was about, at the time, there was a secular party that was trying to basically promote secular public schools and trying to write the rules for the schools in a way that would sort of push out the Catholic education. So there was this battle of Catholic schools versus secular schools. And what they ended up coming up with in 1958 was something called the School Pact. And they adopted a form of school choice in which, as you can tell, if you want, you send your kids to a Catholic school, you send them to a Catholic school. If you want to send them to a secular school, you send them to a secular school. So it was a way in which they had the exact same kind of conflict we're having now, a basic ideological conflict over what are your kids going to be taught. And the solution they came to achieve, you know, this peace for at least the last 50 or 60 years to achieve peace in these school wars was school choice. And that's also figured into the, you know, in Ireland and a couple of other places, that religious element has figured in. And so have questions over school quality. I point out that it's something that can help us solve the mask wars in school and the COVID wars in school, although I consider that a secondary and shorter range thing. The wider range thing is the idea of, instead of having a battle for, you know, who gets to control your kids' education, which political faction gets to control your kids' education, have the parents themselves controlling their kids' education in the most direct way possible, which is they get to decide what schools their kids are going to. And that would allow people to send their kids to traditional schools, traditionalist schools. It would allow them to send them to, you know, woke schools. And I think the majority of us are people who just want to have our kids be taught the three R's and leave it up to ourselves and our kids to decide what our political loyalties are going to be on our own. And I think there'd be a big market for that. So what I want to talk about today was exploring the way in which, you know, what the school wars consist of that we've been having, and how is school choice a potential answer to that?
Thanks, Rob. I want to also invite all of you to ask a question, make a comment. Would also love to hear views from the other side. Like, why do you feel that school choice would be a problem? What are the concerns you have? And then also invited our founder, David Kelly, and my buddy, Scott, up here on the stage, if either of you wanted to weigh.
This is David. I'm interested in this discussion, but I'm going to hold off for a while, so and allow others to follow up on what Rob's saying. Thanks.
Thanks. Scott.
Thank you. Good topic. You know, one thing I was reminded of, I know a few years ago, there was this case in Germany where they were trying to homeschool and they took the family's kids away. That's one issue. Also, you know, when you talked about Youngkin, in Virginia, there's something going on in Michigan as well, where they also came, the Michigan Democrat Party tried saying this weekend that, you know, the client of the public school is not the parent, but the entire community. And I mean, they did have to take that down, but it still is what they believe. So, I mean, I'm for school choice. I kind of bristle at just always focusing on how, you know, they're not fighting CRT the right way. I mean, at some point, we just have to go and take on CRT.
Well, I think fighting it the right way is an important question to be had, because I want to talk about that Michigan Democrat thing, because I just saw that earlier today. And like I said, a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth, and that was definitely fits that definition. What they were naming is the basic premise of public schools as such. And the basic premise of public schools is that the client, the customer of the public schools is the state. It's society as a whole. It's the collective. And so it's the idea of collective control and collective responsibility for your kids' education. That has been the premise of public education from the very beginning. That is inherent in the process of public education. And that's why I'm in favor of school choice as the answer, because a lot of conservatives will not challenge that premise of the state has an interest in your kids' education. They'll just disagree as to what the content of that ought to be.
Maybe like homeschooling cooperative.
That's one. I mean, homeschooling cooperatives is a great example. Now, you talked about Germany, by the way, and that's another great example of there's where the premise of the state is the thing with the primary interest in your kids' education. That's where that comes in, where that's how they can say, you know, they could get engaged in these campaigns against homeschooling, because basically, how dare you be allowed to do that? Now, I understand that there are some cases where you can have some cases where you could have, cults and religious cults and things like that, where they're basically refusing to educate the kids at all. They're just repeating to them propaganda, or, you know, they're not doing the basics of education. And there's, I think, a case to be made that a child has, you know, that the rights of a parent do not extend to abusing a child, and the rights of the parent do not extend to withholding from a child the very basics of education. Now, the very basics has to be defined very basically. There's a case you can make there, but this goes way beyond that. The German case, where it was simply, you know, we, the state, want to dictate what your kids get taught, what the curriculum is, what the standards are, and any way you have of escaping the state education, we are going to cut off. And that's a very German sort of thing to do. And unfortunately, with lots of bad historical overtones that, you know, we must have control over everything. So that's why I'm very much in favor of the idea that, you know, like there are a lot of conservatives, though, who would accept this idea that the state or society has an interest in your kids' education. And so therefore, they don't want to break up the public schools. They want to say, well, we should be in control of the public schools. We should be dictating what gets taught there and making laws about what can't be taught there. And there's that authoritarian impulse that, especially in the religious right, you know, but there's a lot of ironies there, too, in that the religious right has often been on the receiving end of, you know, state control over education. And I'd like to talk about that more later. But that's what I want to head off, is any idea that, well, we just have to fight the woke people. So the way we should do it is to dictate from our perspective what gets taught in the schools. It doesn't solve the underlying problem. And it just, you know, ratchets up the woke wars even more.
I think it's interesting. The German connection isn't entirely incidental when you look back to the beginnings of government schooling in the United mm-hmm. States. There's a common misconception that our country was founded on government schooling, but we had at least a century of our history where education was private and literacy rates were higher than in some cases even today. And it was reformers here in the United States looking to new bureaucratic models overseas, and particularly the Prussian model, which was instituted in part as a response to a feeling that the Prussian state had lost its military readiness, that they needed to systematize education to build better citizens, but also to build better students. And so that's kind of the inheritance that we're dealing with today.
And it involves a lot of very Prussian regimentation and repetition and that sort of thing. And it really lends itself to ideological indoctrination.
When you even look to the etymological root of the term kindergarten, It's a garden that you're cultivating, you're growing young people. Lawrence.
Yes. Hello. Very interesting subject. I, as a homeschooled student for many, many years, I would like to see maybe the concept, you talked about school choice, but maybe get even that term clarified perhaps a little bit more, because my concern with the concept of school choice is that you're giving the power back to the parent, so to speak, but now you're giving this voucher, they can go to any school, and then the school has to admit these people. The state now has pierced the veil through this voucher system, saying, listen, we've given them their voucher, you have to accept these people, or it pierces the realm perhaps even further, where government could get more involved in what private schools teach, because they're saying, look, we have a vested interest. We have given these people their voucher, and that's sort of my concern. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are to that.
Well, I think that's an excellent concern. I've had that concern for a very long time. It's why I was opposed to vouchers for a while. I'm not opposed to vouchers now, because I think it's better than what we have right now, better than the alternative. The system I prefer would be something more like a tax credit. That is, you know, it's not government money that's being given to you that you spend on, that you are then allowed to spend on the schools. It's your own money, and you're simply allowed to claim a tax credit for it. And so it keeps it much more of like, this is your money, not the government's money. And in most cases, you know, a tax credit would make sense, because for most people do pay a significant amount of money in taxes to support education, to support the schools. And I think Ayn Rand advocated a version of that, where she also advocated that if you don't have children yourself, you could get a tax credit to give your money to a charity that would then pay for the education for other kids. Maybe, you know, give money to a private school that you approve of, that they could give as scholarships, and you get a tax credit for that. So the idea is that you could then bring even more money into the private money into the system, even for people, for parents who could not afford on their own to send, even with a tax credit, to send kids to school. So I think that's a better system. Any system's going to be imperfect, because the thing is, there's a mania for control that you're dealing with, right? The fundamental fact is there is a mania for control, this belief that you keep getting repeated, you know, again, from Tony McAuliffe. You get it repeated from these Michigan Democrats, that the state and the collective and society as such, through the government, has an interest and a right in controlling your children. They're not really your children, they're the government's children, and they get to control them. That mania for control is there, and you're going to have to cope with it somehow. So I look for, what are the ways that you can reduce the avenues by which that mania for control can be imposed? So instead of having everybody shunted into the public schools, and then the bureaucrats and the teachers unions in control of the public schools, give people a way to escape the public schools. And it really has to be done by making some kind of distance between the government and the schools. So in Europe, one of the things I found in Europe, a lot of the school choice systems don't have that separation. What they have is that the government directly pays for and supports these different kinds of schools, the secular versus religious, et cetera. And then that support is sort of allocated based on enrollment by the parents, but the money never passes through the parents. The money goes straight from the government to the schools. And obviously, with the First Amendment being what it is, you know, here in the U.S., to the extent anybody still pays any attention to it, you can't do that, because you can't have government directly paying for or supporting religious schools. And I think it would be a really bad idea if they tried. So you have to have the idea of the money goes to the parents, and then the parents spend the money. But like I said, I would prefer the even greater separation of, you get to claim a tax credit on your tax return, but it's your money in the first place that's being spent. So you get even greater separation from the government being able to put rules on it. But yes, I agree, there is a danger that once you had a voucher system, what the fallback position of, you know, they get the mania for control is what's behind all this. The fallback is going to be, well, now that you're receiving vouchers, we're going to come in, we're going to say you have to take these students and you can't choose which students you take. You have to teach a certain curriculum. You have to engage in, you know, you have to comply with certain non-discrimination, you know, anti-discrimination things that we have and our exact interpretation of that. And so we're going to impose a bunch of rules and regulations on you. So there's going to be this mania to use any wedge they can to impose regulations on the curriculum and the policies and every decision a private school makes. But they're kind of doing that already. So so I think it's something we're going to have to cope with in one format and no matter what happens.
David.
Rob, this is – hi. I wanted to go back to something you said. I think your point that the customer of the public schools is not the parents nor the children, but the state. And I think that's a really fundamental point that is not noticed as often as it should be. But there is an argument that goes back to Horace Mann and some people in the 19th century that education is not like other commodities, like, you know, the food that parents provide their children. Because if we have a democracy, that depends on, you know, the cliche is an educated citizenry. And I've always thought, you know, that's not a totally dumb argument. And, you know, it seems smarter and smarter the more elections I follow and the more craziness is going around. So what do you make of that? That it, because education is so closely tied with the knowledge of the world and the ability to think that are exercised in voting, that if we give people the vote, we, you know, if our political system gives people the vote, the political system should also provide somehow either some combination of the opportunity and maybe a requirement to get educated.
And that's, right. There's lots of things we can say about this. So let me just start on it here. First of all, the idea that educated citizenry is important to a republic. I mean, this goes back to Tocqueville. It goes back to Thomas Jefferson. This is the reason why he advocated for the creation of the University of Virginia. Although he also, interesting thing about UVA, since I'm local here, is that when he designed the campus, he designed it without a church. And he did that very deliberately because that was his idea of separation of church and state, right? So you have to, if you're going to have the government providing higher education, you have to not have any religious aspect to it because of the separation of church and state. I think the thing is, you know, this is, and Jefferson's views on this are sort of the wedge people use to say, see, the founders agreed with us too, and we should be doing this. I would say this, to the extent that it is actually true that education is important for the, you know, thriving republic and for maintaining freedom in a free society and having a system where people vote, having that system work, to the extent that that's true, and it is true, then the last person you should want to be in charge of education is government for two reasons. One is because if the purpose of educating the kids is to leave them free to make their own decision, political decisions, and to put the people in charge of the government instead of the government in charge of the people, then you should not have government in charge of the education, because the government's in charge of the education. You know, the whole issue here is, are the people in charge of the government or is the government in charge of the people? Well, for those who want government to be in charge of the people, having control of education is an excellent instrument for making that happen, because the government gets to decide, here's what everybody's taught. Here's, you know, we get to sort of try to dictate what everybody's going to think, what educational basis they have. We get to dictate their curriculum, and therefore we get to basically create the voters that we want to have in order to keep us in office. That is what happens when government's in charge of it. Now, the other reason for government not to be in charge of something that's so important is government is bad at doing things. You know, government is, and I think the ultimate refutation of this Horace Mann argument that we have to have government funding for education because or government control of education because education is so important, is the actual counter argument is what happened once we did that? What happened to the public schools? And what happened to the public schools is they basically went downhill in quality consistently over the last century. And there are whole areas, especially in the big cities, there are whole areas where the public schools are utterly failing to teach the kids anything. And, you know, if you go on Twitter or if you go out and talk to high school kids, or if you Jay Leno used to do this great jaywalking segment on his show where he would go out and he would, you know, stop tourists, I think, on the streets of Hollywood, and he would ask them simple, basic questions. They would have absolutely no idea what the answers were. It really shows that, you know, the biggest argument against public schooling is the actual result, which is people are not getting the education they need to make good decisions and to keep our republic thriving and healthy. So I think, you know, we need the alternative to that. We need some other way of getting a better education put out into the hands of the parents.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. I just have a follow-up because you mentioned the very poor quality of many public schools. I've heard libertarians who were arguing in favor of private education, or at least the option of private education for parents, arguing that I've heard two arguments. The first is that public schools, if you look at the educational results, the private schools and homeschooling often show up better. The results are better for the kids than at public schools. But the second argument, and this goes back to Europe, is, you know, they look at educational statistics and achievements across countries and say, well, that U.S. Students lag behind other countries. And that always puzzled me because I thought, and maybe I'm wrong given what you've said, I thought that was crazy because European schools are all public, or at least funded by public money. So is that not the case? Because if I was thinking of France in particular, I just assume most of the schools there are state-run or state, certainly state-funded, and that's the opposite of what libertarians are arguing for in this country. So that if European students are doing better, or Japanese students are doing better than U.S. students on math and education and so forth, that sounds to me more like an argument for public schooling. So what am I missing here? Maybe I'm just wrong about Europe and other countries.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because people have said that Europe has a better educational system in some ways, but a worse education system in some other ways. I think, you know, we talk about how terrible the education system here is in America, and yet we produce, you know, most a disproportionate number of the world's inventions and innovations and high technology and scientific breakthroughs, et cetera. Now, that's partly because we bring in, you know, all the best immigrants from everywhere else, but it's also our native people. So, you know, the people who were born and came through the education system here. So a couple things on that. I haven't waded too deeply in this. I'm not an expert in this, but I've sort of followed some of the people who are. And every discussion about school quality has to deal with selection effects. So, for example, when you talk about public schools versus private schools, I have to confess one of the reasons why private schools perform so much better than public schools is because who goes to private schools? Well, primarily it's the children of better off, better educated parents, right? It's the people with college degrees who are making, you know, who have professional jobs, who are, you know, making good money, who are generally tend to be more educated, put more emphasis on their more. It also means people go to private schools are come from parents who have put greater importance in education because they're not willing to, you know, they could just send their kids to the public schools and not pay anything at all. They're willing to shell out the extra money to get a better education for their kids. So you're going to get selection effects. You're going to get, you know, kids who are, you know, you're going to get my kids go to a private school and here they are, they're getting, you know, a huge education just at home, just in the environment, in the home environment they're in, that gives them a huge advantage. So that's part of what's going on. And I think that's also goes on in comparisons between the US and Europe. where I think to some extent, you know, the U.S. has factors in the population distribution in the U.S. that can sometimes, you know, drag down our numbers relative to, you know, like a small European country where everybody's middle class is going to be much more, you know, even if they have private or public schools, the parents and the social environment that the kids are coming from is going to be much better. Another factor that goes in there that's a complicating factor is educational fads. Because sometimes, you know, what happened in America is you had things like progressive education that came through and often were a wrecking ball, that it didn't matter who was managing the schools. It was the educational, fashionable educational theories that came through that were a wrecking ball and reduced readership rates. I mean, you know, there was a whole, people might remember 30 years or so ago, there was a whole, you know, there was a company called Hooked on Phonics, and there was a whole movement to bring back phonics, which is the way I was brought up learning how to read, which is a way that just works. It works beautifully. It had been wholesale abandoned in favor of these crackpot methods that failed at teaching kids to read. And it was because such a disaster in the schools that this method that worked had been swept out and a method that didn't work had been brought in, that you had this whole market that opened up for people to market these phonics teaching materials to parents to give to their own kids to help them learn how to read outside of school. So there have been cases where educational fads sweep through the schools. And so if that fad doesn't hit France, but it hits America, our numbers are going to go down and theirs are going to be better. A last factor that I think probably has a lot to do with France is a very centralized national, everything's done nationally. It's all centralized in Paris, has been basically since Louis XIV. And, that can be a bad thing in some ways. It can be a good thing in other ways because in America, I think what happens is the schools that are really failing badly are failing badly because they come from very corrupt local political systems. So, you know, I used to live in Chicago and I'm not sending my kids to public school in Virginia. There's no way I would ever accept my kids to public school in Chicago because you have this corrupt, politically dominated local government that really can't be trusted to do just about anything, much less to run an educational system. So you're going to get local areas. So our tradition of local control of schools in America has some positive aspects, but it means that you can have, especially in the sort of corrupt, mismanaged, politically distorted environment of some of the big cities, can produce spectacularly failing schools in a way that wouldn't happen if you had a more centralized education system. So those are just some of the complicating factors that come in here.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. That's fascinating.
Thanks, David. I also want to recognize a few people that are here in the chat with us. The chairman of the board of the Atlas Society, Jay LaPere, is here, as well as our senior scholar, Professor Stephen Hicks, who has written quite extensively about education, in particular the philosophies of education. And so I'd like to recommend that you check out our most recent pocket guide to philosophies of education, which Professor Hicks has written the introduction to. So JP, thanks for joining us. Did you have a thought, one away?
More of a question, really. I am fascinated with the pandemic wave of criticism over critical race theory in the States. I am far more acquainted as to with the way that our Latin American system was subverted. And I delved into this issue for U.S. history, and I would like to get if there's more knowledgeable people on the stage that can instruct me and as to what what's the history of this trend? Because one of the things that really strikes me is that I when I first understood that critical race theory was just one of the many applications of critical theory that have been playing out in the academy and down into public education for a very, very long time. How old is this process of subversion of the education system, which is probably the reason for the claim that the left, the radical left, won the culture war, the culture wars?
Okay, I'm not the best expert on all of that. I think the critical race theory is in the form it's taking now is more recent. And it has to do with these theories sort of reaching a critical mass. People have been trying to push this for decades. It's only, for example, one of the things that happened in the 2008 election when Barack Obama was first running, one of the things that came out was his connection to a guy named Billy Ayers, who was a terrorist, like a leftist terrorist during the 60s, during the hippie movement of the 60s. Who later then got off on a technicality and never went to jail and ended up being a professor of education and a very influential professor of education. So there's this whole theory of education that's been going on since the 1960s that's about how education should basically, it was the original woke education. It was the idea that education should be there to train people to be political revolutionaries, essentially. To train, indoctrinate kids into socialist ideas. So this has been going on a long time. I think it's only really sort of started becoming noticeable in the curriculum in a serious way in the last 10 years, 10 to 15 years. And that's what's causing this. But we have the school wars in America have a very long history in different iterations that I think is important to keep in mind. So the version that I remember from the sort of 60s, 70s, and 80s, although it goes back even farther, it goes back to the 1920s, was the battle over teaching evolution in schools, right? So there were the Christians who said, we think that teaching of evolution should be banned in the public schools, or that teaching of creationist theories of the origins of life should be taught instead. Or should taught instead, and then their fallback position is creationism should be taught alongside evolution as an alternative theory. So there was this sort of argument about the religious content and of education, in which it was the religious conservatives who were the ones wanting to impose something on the curriculum. And looking at the history of this sort of the school wars in America, I discovered something that it surprised me. The King James version of the Bible used to be highly controversial. As you know, everything, all the battles we're having over the 1619 project were once battles over the King James version of the Bible. And that sounds crazy, but what happened was that when they created some, this is what I talk about, saying that the public school systems inherently create this problem. In some of the first state laws that created public schools, they mandated as part of that religious instruction should be part of the public school curriculum. And when that came along, when that was implemented, what that religious instruction tended to take the form of was readings from the King James Version of the Bible. Now, then this is like the biggest, most influential English language translation of the Bible for hundreds of years. And the reason why that was controversial is the Catholics objected. They said, this is a Protestant version of the Bible that you're having them read. And that's, you're trying to inculcate our children with Protestantism. And you're doing this to sort of drive out Catholic ideas about religion. And of course, a lot of the people who proposed doing this said, yes, that's the point. That's what we're trying to do. We don't like these Catholics. We want to inculcate Protestantism in your kids because we're opposed to Catholicism. And that was across the 19th century, I found this fascinating history. There were riots, there were demonstrations, there were court battles. And the upshot of all this, and it happened over a period of decades through the 19th century. And the general upshot of it was that the solution was to basically push prayer out of the public schools.
and to push religious instruction out of the public schools to make public education secular. So therefore, it couldn't be either Protestant or Catholic. It would be or Jewish or whatever. It wouldn't be for or against any one religion. It would be neutral on the religious content, and the religion would be pushed out of the public schools. Now, the problem, of course, is 100 years later, after that battle, we now have a new sort of quasi-religion, or following that, you had people with secular ideologies that they wanted to impose on the schools. And so you have, the schools are nominally secular, but they're actually there to impose somebody's sort of quasi-religious philosophy of life onto your kids. And so we're still dealing with the same problem. Now, I'm sure there's a lot more to this history that other people can tell you. This is the parts that I can sort of name off the top of my head here.
Thanks, Rob. And JP, the two most, I'd say, expert on critical race theory and the history of critical theory in the United States on our faculty would be Professor Stephen Hicks and also Professor Jason Hill. So do check out the events section of our site for upcoming Clubhouse chats with them. I also believe that Professor Hicks and Professor Salzman tomorrow will be doing a live webinar. So that might be another opportunity to ask your question then, because it's an important one. And I know one that Professor Hicks in particular has covered extensively. Alan.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Rob. As someone whose son is currently in the California school system and who is dealing with these issues in real time, this subject is near and dear to my heart. As an aside to what you were saying, Rob, I would point out that when you refer to France, that it's a matter of scale, that geographically France is a small enough country to be essentially culturally homogenous, something we don't have in the United States. And that to also say that part of that whole system included Le Bac, which was the slang for that final exam that high school students had to go through, which made them all sweat and which was very tough. So it'd be interesting to see now that they've removed that, essentially, I forget, either they've removed it or they've lowered the standards to it. It will be interesting to see what happens to the education in France now that that's happened. Anyways, having said that, when we're talking about the educational system here, I'm dealing with this in relation to math, because they're now lowering mm-hmm. the expectations and the requirements for math. But as a kind of just to offer it to you and as well as to the room, and then point out an example that I forget, it's the National Conference of Math Teachers is the largest organization of math teachers. There's a report that came out that has said that math scores in the last 10 years have not changed, and essentially in the last 60 years have essentially stayed the same. And so that what you were talking about all these newfangled teaching methods essentially have done nothing to improve the math scores. And what I am going to posit is the idea that in America, we keep trying to find a solution to this problem. And that my answer is that the problem is that the problem is a, is the parents, and that they are not, when it comes to elementary school and through high school, the parents are simply not demanding enough of their students, of their children. And as an example of this, Asian students on average spend 13 hours a week studying and doing homework, whereas all other groups combined spend only 5 minutes. I'm not 5 minutes, 5 hours a week. So that, and that's reflected in the scores. So that really it's the culture of, I think it's okay, I'm sending you off to school, you teach my kid, I have nothing to do with it. That culture that seems to be prevalent in America has more to do with it than anything else. And what you see is educators either genuinely trying to solve that problem, which can't be solved because you can't control the parents and you can only demand so much, and or using something like CRT to indoctrinate children, which I heard in a room someone say, yeah, we need CRT so that we can get reparations passed. But I'll end with that, and I'm wondering on your comments about that, because to me, that seems to be the big issue that's happening in America.
Okay, so two observations of that. One is there was a long article, I think in the New York Times, that I read years ago, that was very illuminating on this. It was about a place in, I think it was a suburb in either Maryland or Michigan. It was Maryland or Michigan, one of the two, a state that began with M. But it was a middle class suburb where there were a lot of middle class, well off black parents who were there, and they had, a lot of them had moved there because the local schools were supposed to be very good, and they thought, well, if I move here, my kids will do better at school and they'll be better off. And then they were disappointed that there was still this disparity in the school district, that the black students weren't doing as well as the white students. And so they brought in a Harvard professor, like a Harvard sociologist, to embed in the community and spent like a year there or 6 months there, and tried to figure out what's at the root of this. Where is this? And the idea was they're bringing him to find out where is the secret hidden systemic racism that's causing this disparity. And what this guy came up with, this is a black professor at Harvard, but he was an African immigrant, which I think gave him a slightly different angle on things. And what he came up with was exactly what you're saying. He says the problem is with the parents, that a lot of that they have different attitudes towards education, that a lot of the white parents have the attitude that, you know, they're on top of the kids saying, you have to do your homework, you have to do this, you have to do that, I'm monitoring you to make sure that you're doing well. Whereas a lot of the black parents had the idea, well, I moved to this suburb because they had a good school system. It's the school system's job to educate my child. And that job, you know, happens at the school and it doesn't happen back at home. And my job is not to be on top. Now, he did not win himself any friends by coming to this conclusion, of course, because they all wanted to be told it's not their fault, it's somebody else's fault. Now, on the other hand, there is this whole long debate between, in Britain, they call it between the top. The phone call came in and interrupted her. In Britain, it's a conflict with what they call the tiger mom and the tiger mom. So the tiger mom, you know, is the tiger mother is the sort of the idea of the Asian parent who is on top of their kid and making them do 13 hours of homework a week. And the tiger mom is more the sort of gentle, soft and cuddly. You're more emotional, more concerned about your child's emotional well-being, and you're less lax. And I would point out, though, that the tiger mom framework is not necessarily the best, because you often have the Asian students, especially in Asia, this is even more the case in China, you have the Asian students who are doing all this homework and they're obsessed with the tests and passing the tests. But then when they go out into the world, you know, 10 years later, 20 years later, they're not producing as many innovations. They're not their thinking is not as creative as the American kids. Whereas here in America, we tend to have a system that's less on cracking the whip and having to do lots of homework, but more on instilling a lifelong love of learning and teaching teaching self-motivation. Now, I'm on a soapbox about this because I have Montessori kids, and you know, my kids are going, or my oldest is now he's in high school, so it's not a Montessori school, but it's a school full of Montessori kids who came from the school he went to when he was younger. And the big advantage of this Montessori approach to education, it is so focused, unlike traditional public school education, unlike this sort of German regimented German model, Prussian model, and unlike the tiger mother Asian approach, it's much more focused on the idea of making the kids self-motivated. And you know, the figures you'll always hear by us Montessori fanatics is, you know, the Google guys, the guy founders of Google are Montessori kids. That there's a disproportionate number of people who are out there in top creative and innovative fields who came from this Montessori background. And I think that is the thing that's sort of missing from the, I do think it hugely important to have parents involved and taking their kids' education seriously. I see the results of that with my kids, and the advantage they have from, the advantage I had, I talked about how as a writer, one of the biggest advantages I had is my dad correcting my grammar from the time I was 5 years old, you know, so that the rules of, you know, my father was also a writer. So the rules of grammar and how to speak and how to use words correctly, that was all something I picked up, you know, as a kid around the house from the time I was as young as I can remember. That's hugely important. It's not necessarily, you know, go do 15 hours of homework a week, because it can also be a matter too of teaching the kids to be self-motivated and self-directed. And I think that's the advantage that the more American system has. But like I said, it's not because of the Prussian regimentation brought into the public schools. It's more because that's just part of the American culture. So I think it is true that culture, the culture of the country as a whole, America has some advantages and some disadvantages. We can be very anti-intellectual, which goes against, it creates a sort of headwind for education in our culture. But we're also very much more focused on people being independent, self-motivated individuals, which is why I think that people who do well in school go on to create so much more afterwards, is because they have that American spirit of creativity and individualism and self-motivated thinking. That means that not everybody's going to do well in our education system, but those who make it through will actually do even better than people, you know, from other cultures that are less self-motivated, less creative, less in favor of independent thinking.
Terrific. Well, that takes us right up to the top of the hour. So, Rob, thank you very much. Great topic. Little different than we usually do, but a lot of food for thought. I want to thank our founder, David Kelly. Thank everyone who joined us up on stage to ask a question. And again, please check out the events section of our site. We've got a busy next couple of weeks. Again, as mentioned, we've got our current events tomorrow with Professor Hicks and Professor Salzman. And then Professor Salzman and I will be doing a clubhouse on Thursday on price controls. And then next week, again, we're going to be talking about enlightened self-interest with Rob on Tuesday, and then we will be back with our founder, David Kelly, on fact versus opinion the following Thursday. So, wonderful conversation. Really appreciate it, and I will see you guys later in the week.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.